Welcome to another edition of Children of Song, the podcast that explores what it must have been like to grow up surrounded by music. For those of you who might be joining us for the first time, we're speaking, of course, with musicians whose parents made it big in the music industry, or those artists who started playing and making music when they were still very young. For these folks, making music is as natural as breathing. Today's guest fits in that second category. We'll learn how his father first introduced him to the guitar, and then once he showed some talent, how he took him to various honky-tonks where he showcased his skills at just 10 years old. But first, I'm Brad Newman, the producer of this series, and today I'll be doing a little double duty, taking on the hosting chores for what should be a very fun, entertaining episode. We're bringing this to you from our podcast studios in Midtown Manhattan. Rick Buser is our engineer. You know, today's guest came to Nashville as a singer-songwriter, but made a living writing big hits for folks like Chris Stapleton, Gary Allen, George Strait, and many others. And then finally in his 40s, he said, you know, come on now, let's do this thing. He's just released his first album, but it's really a culmination of the work he's been doing his whole life. The album is called Lowdown and Lonesome. You got to get out there and get it. It's really got some beautiful songs in there. It's been described as down-home country meets rock and roll. There's a beautiful, soulful beat, and especially the title track, which you heard a little bit of there. We're pleased to welcome Kendall Marvel with us to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Nice to meet you, sir.
Good to meet you.
So give us a sense of where you grew up. I know you're raised in Southern Illinois, is that right?
Yep.
And you wouldn't necessarily think that's sort of music central, but there are some really interesting clubs and musicians that have come out of that part of the country.
There are. It's a very rural area, you know, a lot of coal mines, a lot of farming, that kind of thing. So, you know, coal miners and farmers tend to want to get out on a weekend and kick around a little bit and drink beer and hear live music, and especially back when I was growing up in that area, I think there's a lot less nowadays honky tonks, places to play, you know, what I considered honky tonks back in the day.
But your daddy, was he a music lover?
He was, and a pseudo musician. You know, I mean, he could play a little bit. He actually played in my band for a while once we got going. But yeah, he was a pretty good, you know, decent guitar player, and lived vicariously through me. You know, once he figured it out and taught me a few things, he was like, hey, this is going to be fun, you know.
Well, he actually gave you a guitar pretty early, right?
He did. I was 5 when I got my first guitar, yeah.
Amazing. And, you know, listen, I've had 5-year-olds. They're a little older now, my girls. They don't always take to you know, instruments. I mean,
sure.
How did he introduce this to you, and what did you think at the time?
You know, I really don't remember exactly how that went down, but apparently I liked it because I don't, you know, I don't recall being too, you know, any 5-year-old wants to go out and play, which, you know, I always wanted to do that when we had friends over, but we'd always had, you know, I had to play guitar first, you know, when he was having, and they was pretty wild. They had some pretty wild parties back in the day, and when the parties were going on, then I knew I had to work, you know, before I could go out and play with the other kids.
He wanted to show you off a little bit.
He did, yeah. He used to get me up at night, you know, when he'd come home from the bars or whatever before I was going out at him, and he'd get me up and make me play. I remember Mom get mad and, you know, say, he's got to go to school tomorrow. And he was like, no, he don't have to go to school tomorrow.
So what kind of music did you play? I mean, who were these, you know, his idols growing up, you know, the people he liked? Or was this something, people that were inspiring you too? And it was kind of working in a double way there.
A little of both. I mean, he grew up in the 60s, you know, so he was, you know, the Doors and the Beatles and all that kind of stuff. He was a rock and roller when he was young. But and I can remember going to see Alice Cooper, you know, in the 70s. But he was more of a country lover. You know, the older he got, the more he liked country music.
So give us a sense of what he might have asked you to play. Can I hear something?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I can remember one of the first songs that he helped me learn was a Hank Jr. song. Just a little waltzy. I kicked the habit of smoking back some time ago. I tried
tried the hard stuff, but I had to let all that go. But the toughest thing I ever gave up was today. Cause old habits like you are hard to break.
You know, stuff like that. As a kid, I didn't know what the song meant. But I sure liked the way that chord sounded, you know, when he showed me how to play that.
Yeah.
And I guess it was a natural rhythm thing, because it's not really, as a child, easy to play a waltz, you know.
Right. Also, but also some low notes there must have been hard to hit. Was it like a novelty also for some of these adults looking? I mean, did they laugh or did they take you seriously?
Oh, they took me serious. I mean, they was mesmerized by it. I've had a remarkable low voice my whole life. So, when I was 10 years old, I kind of sounded like a man, like a grown man singing.
Wow.
It was very God given. You know, it was very, very strange.
So, you know, obviously you get better as you go on. You're like 10 years old, and instead of becoming like, you know, parties at the house where people would come over and listen to you play, he starts taking you to bars.
Sure, yep.
And how did this transpire? Because, you know, coming up to a bar, unless he had a relationship with the ownership there, it's not like, hey, listen, my kid, you know.
Oh, he had a relationship with a lot of them, believe me. There was a place in West Frankfort, Illinois called Charlie's. And he used to hang out there all the time. And that was one of the first places that he ever took me to. He just said, hey, I'm going to bring my boy up. And I'd play a few songs. And then pretty soon, you know, they was like giving him beer. You know, and then it was like, okay, we're going to do this a lot, you know. bring your boy up and let him play some songs and you can drink for free. You know, and I'd make some tips. You know, I'd make $10 or $15, and I was in hog heaven. You know,
yeah.
I loved it.
What was some big reaction that you got? Was there a crowd pleaser where you started to think? I mean, because remember, it's interesting as a young person too. You work a room differently,
mm-hmm.
and your senses seem to pick up on things maybe quicker than even adults.
Right.
I mean, you were learning your chops. Obviously, you're a really young kid, but was there a particular song or a particular type of song that...
Anything that I cussed in, it seemed to go over well, you know. There's a Hank Jr. song, if you don't like Hank Williams, you can kiss our ass. And it was just like, that stuff like that, all the adults wanted to hear that. You know, they'd laugh, but they dug it, you know. It wasn't like a ha-ha laugh, you know.
When did you start writing your own music?
I mean, when I was a teenager, I messed with it a little bit. Nothing major. It was my late 20s before I really started learning the craft of songwriting. You know, I mean, I wrote songs, but looking back, they wasn't any count.
What was the key to that? You know, coming up with a lyric or a lick first?
A little of both. I mean, it just depends. Sometimes you got a cool melody, you know, and you run it by somebody else, and they have a cool title or. You know, or whatever. So it goes different ways, you know.
Can I hear an early one? Something that maybe you don't love now, but there's an aspect of it that was a little bit of a foreshadowing to the type of writer that you would become?
Well, that's kind of tough because when I moved to Nashville and really started writing songs, I'm sure I had some horrible ones and I can't even hardly remember them.
You know, it's interesting because I've been doing this a little bit now and I've talked to a bunch of singer-songwriters. Sometimes they'll play me something that they think is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a while, you know, like 20 years. And I think the thing that inspired them to write those first words might not have sunk in, but after 20 years they have. And I almost want to play it back for them. I'm like, I don't know, call me crazy, but this sounds fantastic.
Right. You know, back in those days as a writer, I wasn't writing for myself, you know, so I was more looking to whoever, you know, we get a pitch sheet, you know, at the office at a publishing company and it says, you know, Luke Bryan, blah, 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 all these people, they're recording this week of this month and here's what they're looking for. And so we'd be aiming for something like that. So a lot of that stuff, you know, was just not necessarily stuff that I would really particularly like, but that's what I've done to make a living.
Sure. It was a job.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about when you first got to Nashville. What brought you there? How old were you? And, you know, here were this kid from Southern Illinois. I mean, what made you think that you could go to that big city, that big music town, and do something?
Well, I was a grown man. I was 28 years old when I moved there. And we had two little kids at the time. My daughter was 7 and my boy was 2. And I was working. I'd played local bars up there for years, and I'd come back and forth to Nashville. You know, it's only about 3.5-hour drive from where I'm from. And, you know, I just expected people just to walk up and offer me a record deal. You know, I was a little lazy, you know, when it comes to like, no, they'll come find me. Well, they never did, you know. But I did meet a lawyer in town, a guy named Scott Simon. Years later, he came on to be a manager for Tim McGraw. He manages Tim McGraw to this day. And he, out of the blue, called me. I hadn't played music in probably a year and a half, 2 years. I'd kind of, you know, I still played around the house, but I wasn't out performing. And he called and said, like, hey, you still sing? Because he met me when I was a teenager. And I lied and said, sure I do, yeah. And he was like, come down and play me some songs. So that's kind of what I done. And he was like, hey, man, you got anything you wrote? And I played him a couple things that I'd written. He was like, well, you need to write some songs because them aren't very good. And he's like, you know, nobody's going to give you songs, you know, because you're nobody. They're going to give them to Tim McGraw and Kenny Chesney and George Strait. And, you know, that kind of struck a nerve with me. I was like, really? And now, coming from a songwriter, I understand totally what he was talking about. Like, you know, you kind of want, you know, when you're trying to make a living writing songs, you want them guys to cut your songs. You're not going to give it to me.
Right.
You know, so that's when I started writing songs and started, you know, really trying to figure it out.
Well, you must have been inspired on that first evening in Nashville, because I think on the very first evening, you wrote yourself a hit song that Gary Allen made famous. We heard him sing a little bit of it. He was actually on the podcast not too long ago. I'd sure like to hear about how you wrote that song and how quickly it came together for you. Was it Lightning in a Bottle?
Yes, it was Lightning in a Bottle. I was writing with one of my friends, Casey Beathard, who's a great songwriter. He's had a ton of hits. At that time, he had not, and that was actually our first hit song. But yeah, he was my first co-write the day that I moved to Nashville. And I knew him, you know, we was friends, you know, from me coming back and forth. And I just had this guitar lick and was playing it, and he was like, "What's that?" And I was like, "I don't know. I kind of like it though." And he was like, "I do too." And he had the title, and he said, "I got this title about this," and it pretty well fell out. I mean, maybe 2 hours.
Wow.
We might have went to lunch, you know, and come back and carved on a little bit, fixed it up a little more. Dotted an I and crossed a T or something.
Let's hear a little bit of that.
Here's the 1999 hit, Right Where I Need to Be.
There's a plane flying out here tonight. Destination New Orleans. Boss man says my big promotion's on the line, and that's right where I need to be. Lately I've been on the road more than I've been home. All this leaving her alone's killing me. And holding her right now has got me thinking more and more. This is right where I need to be. Where when I hear her, I can see her, I can smell her sweet perfume. I can feel her skin against me when I sleep. And I won't miss her, I can kiss her anytime that I want to. Yeah, that's right where I need to be. Oh yeah, that's right where I need to be.
Really nice.
Thank you.
You know, your songwriting is, you know, your songs are a little sad. And, you know, I was talking to Gary Allen, actually. This is fitting, obviously, right where I need to be.
Sure.
He sang that for us, and he's gone through it. But he said when he was a kid, the great Harlan Howard, the famous songwriter,
sure,
he said to him, said, "You can write, son, but you just got nothing to say." He said, "You need to go out and get yourself divorced a few times." So
he did, yeah.
And he did. But what's the secret for you, Kendall? Because, I mean, I got to tell you, you know, you have this great beard for people at home who can't see him.
Uh-huh.
And you're very distinguished looking, but you have this sort of effervescent, positive glow about you. You don't seem
that.
Like the guy that can get this deep.
You know, it's just, I don't know what you'd call it, because, I mean, I think like I've, I mean, I'm married to the same woman. We've been married 26 years. We haven't lived hard. I mean, we haven't starved to death. I mean, looking back, I mean, yeah, we was poor. But I don't know. It's just one of the – I guess it comes natural, you know. And I learned from a lot of great songwriters. You know, I was lucky enough to get in a room with Harlan Howard, Max D. Barnes, some of them guys from the old school that, you know, were just classic songwriters. And the guys like Casey Beathard and Max T. Barnes, Max D.'s son, and I just learned the craft from them guys. Mm-hmm. And kind of, you know, learned how to tell a story, write a movie or a book in 3 minutes. You know, right. that's kind of the way to do it.
You know, it is very interesting because we haven't talked to a lot of songwriters who did it strictly for a living. Like mm-hmm. you said, you get a call sheet or some kind of sheet that says, listen, Coca-Cola's coming in. We want this really good-looking kid to mm-hmm. sing a song that's somehow going to get people to buy Coke.
Sure.
I mean, is that frustrating? Does it make you laugh? Or
it's pretty frustrating, yeah. I mean, that's just the typical. I guess it's always been that way. It seems now, these days, it's worse than ever, but I'm sure it just goes through cycles like that where it's all, you know, everything is look-oriented. You know, video killed the radio star is the way I look at it. You know, back in the 70s and 80s and earlier when you had John Conley's and guys that didn't look like, you know, wasn't up here on Billboard, hanging on the Billboard in Times Square, you know, because they wasn't very good-looking dudes, but they could sing their brains out, you know, and I'd love to go back to those. And I think we are kind of going back to those times a little bit. There's some guys having a lot of success that don't necessarily fit the profile of what's been going on here lately.
What do you think about some of these good-looking kids that do get some hit songs that you've written? I mean, you know, Jake Owen is a good-looking kid. You know, you wrote Starting With Me uh-huh. for him. I mean, you know, was that a good experience? Has it been a good experience? Or is it frustrating to see some of these big, cool hits just float away with somebody else?
No, that wasn't because, I mean, me and Jake had a lot of success together. You know, I had 6 or 7 songs on that first record, and he's actually a good singer, you know what I mean?
He is.
And live, I mean, he can do exactly what he sounds like on the record live. Some people out there aren't necessarily as good live as they, you know, as they sound. They can't really do what they do in the studio, and that's kind of frustrating sometimes. But no, Jake's a great singer, and he's a great writer. You know what I mean? We wrote some great songs. But Starting With Me was the first song we wrote. And I remember the night before we was writing, I was writing with his producer, Jimmy Ritchie. And he called me and he was like, hey, man, I got this new kid I'm working with from Florida. And the first thing he said was, he's a good-looking dude, man. The girls are going to love him. And I thought, oh, great, you know. It's going to be one of those. But he was a great, great singer. And we wrote some good stuff and made some money and had a lot of fun. And we're still buddies.
Yeah. No, I know. I know that he comes down and participates in the little honky-tonk.
He does, yeah.
Thing that you do. But we're going to get to that a little later. You want to give me a little taste of Starting With Me?
Sure, yeah. Had a one-night stand with my best friend's baby sister. To this day, he still won't speak to me. Pawned my grandpa's old guitar in college for a case of beer and a tank of gasoline. And I took the swing at my old man one Christmas. Never dreamed that it would be his last. I wish my mom had wrung my neck when she called me with those cigarettes, which reminds me I'm down to my last pack. And if I had a dime for half the things I did that didn't make no sense at all, I'd be living a little higher on the hog. Only I'd have known that later on down the road I'd look back and not like what I see. I'd have changed a lot of things, starting with me.
That's so nice.
Oh, thank you.
You're listening to Children of Song. I'm Brad Newman, and today my guest is the singer-songwriter Kendall Marvel. You know, let's talk about this collaboration with Chris Stapleton. I mean, has this guy blown up in the last couple of years or what?
It's crazy. It's crazy how big he's got.
And, you know, I mean, you guys started working together, what, 15 years ago?
Yeah, around that area, yeah.
How many songs have you written together?
I would say we've written a good 60 songs together in that ballpark, you know.
Take me through the process a little bit. You know, how does it work with him? And obviously if you've written 60 songs together, you really know each other well.
We do, yeah. He's a freak of nature. I mean, the first time I met him, it was just like, who in the world is this guy? And he sings so good and plays so good, and his songs are so deep for a young dude. He was, you know, he was a young man at the time, you know, mid-20s. And it was just, I mean, it's effortless to write with him. If we don't get a song in a couple hours, we're not finished, then we're going to go drink a beer or something, you know, because he's not going to work on it that, you know, if it don't come pretty easy, then, you know, with him, which it always does.
Can you give me a sense of maybe one of the first songs you wrote together where you knew, boy, this was something special, this collaboration?
Sure, yeah. One of the, we had, actually, Blake Shelton cut this song. It's called Never Loving You. I can't see the day, I won't want to stay out with the boys all night. Oh, and I can't see the day when I walk off this dead-end job for good. I can't see the day I won't be afraid of getting older. But no matter what I do, honey, I can't see me never loving you. Some things are bound to change, but some things stay the same like they ought to. Yeah, some things are meant to be, just like you and me together. If I die today, or if I find a way to live forever, no matter what I do, honey, I can't see me never loving you.
Oh, man, it's so great.
Well, thank you.
You know, one of the songs that you wrote together was Either Way, which is just Chris and a guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And it's from the album Songs from a Room, Volume 1, which was, you know, just released last May, obviously. Let's take a listen.
Sure.
You know, it must be in the studio when you hear that, like the first or second time, you've got, it's amazing.
Oh, it's, and that's exactly, you know, back at home we'll demo songs, we'll go in and hire a band and do the full production. I would say 60 to 70% of the songs we wrote was just like that.
Yeah.
And we got songs cut on them. We got Blake Shelton, Leanne Womack actually recorded that song right there, and it was just him on a cassette player. And who else? Josh Turner. We had a lot of songs like that, and just, you know, just him and the guitar playing, or me and the guitar playing, whichever one. But
so, who wrote that high, you know, the melody there at the end where he really is wailing? I mean, there's something, there's a pain in his voice that is just that, and that's sad. That song is so sad.
Oh, it is sad as hell. It's just one of them things too that it's just like, there's something about those songs that jump an octave, because it's really just three chords in the whole song, just like Right Where I Need to Be.
Uh-huh.
It just jumps up an octave. And there's something about doing that in a song that just makes it to me. Mm-hmm. And especially when you sing like him. So, you know what I mean? I do that song live as well, but I sure don't do it in that key because he is up there on that thing.
That song obviously was recently, he was nominated for Best Country Solo Performance for a 2018 Grammy. And, you know, you also wrote two songs on his latest album, Songs from a Room, Volume 2, which was just released last week. I suppose he needs to work on naming these albums a little bit. But, you know, it's funny, Noah, and I say that in a jokingly way, because to him it is about the music,
right.
And it would have to be
with
an album with that title.
And he has never, he's always been that way. He's really kind of a shy guy, pretty quiet dude.
Mm-hmm.
You get a couple whiskey drinks in him now, he can get loud and fun. But, yeah, he's always been pretty reserved and not a flash guy. You're not going to see him doing a bunch of media stuff, you know, nothing crazy.
Right.
You know, it's not me, look at me. He's not that kind of guy at all.
He's got to be a pretty deep guy. I mean, give me something of what it's like without, you know, telling a secret about your friendship is going to ruin it. But, you know, something about him that people might not expect. I mean, he's got to be a pretty deep guy.
He is a deep guy. And, you know, he's really smart. He was valedictorian in his high school class. He went to Vanderbilt University for a little bit. And, you know, they don't let dummies in Vanderbilt. They would not let me in Vanderbilt, I promise you. But, yeah, he's really intellectually smart. And you hear some of his songs, they're so country, you know, the lyrics, because, you know, he grew up in Kentucky,
uh-huh.
Very rural, just the same way I did. But he's really smart lyrically. But he can take a song, and it can still be very smart, but the average person who – it's just so relatable. They get it. You know what I mean?
Right. I heard you took him to your hometown to play a little concert, and your daddy came to see him.
Uh-huh.
What do you think of that?
Oh, cool. I mean, he blew everybody away. You know, and at the time, Chris had a flat top and wore horn-rimmed glasses and had no hair on his face, you know. And him and Morgan were dating, and of course, she came and sang with him. And my dad is my biggest fan ever, you know. I remember after the show, he kind of pulled me over to the side. He said, "Son, that was great. You know, you guys were awesome. You're sounding awesome." He said, "But you might want to be careful with who you bring home and not bring somebody that good. You know, who's, in other words, who's better than you next time, you know." And if it had been anybody else, you know, if it had been any other songwriter buddies or singers, it probably would have pissed me off. But hell, he's better than everybody. So that's just the way it is.
Let's talk about coming out for your own party here. There's some great tracks on this album. How do you do it when, you know, you've been writing for all this time for everybody else, and then now you got to put together 10, 12 tracks for yourself?
You know, it's harder than what I thought it would be. You know, sure, I could have threw 10 songs together and they all been pretty cool songs, but making a record, I find out, is a whole different thing than just throwing a couple hit-sounding songs on there and then filling it up with a bunch of other songs that sound like hits. It kind of had to have a vein, and that's what we started with Low Down and Lonesome. You know, it was like, I want to do a concept record, and in all the songs, I'm either low down or I'm lonesome. So, you know, we started digging through songs, and we picked out four or five older songs that we liked, and then me and my producer, Keith Gaddis, went to work writing and wrote the rest of it.
Talk to me about Gypsy Woman a little bit.
That's one of my favorites.
Oh, God, it's fun.
Thanks.
That is a good song.
He actually came, Keith came in with that song, and he'd already started it, and he played me a verse and a chorus of it. And he was like, "Man, I think we're missing something like this." And I was like, "Is that done?" And he was like, "No, it's not done." I said, "Well, what's wrong with that then? Let's finish that." You know, he opened the door a little bit, and I stuck my foot in it. You know? One of them kind of things. That's one of my favorite tracks.
I would think the crowds really like that one, too.
It's the sing-along song. You know, it's funny to go somewhere now, you know, coming from a songwriting world. Yeah, I'm used to them singing along with my hits I've written for other people, but not my songs.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been a couple times. I think we was up in Minneapolis a couple weeks ago playing up there, and, you know, people were singing along to it. It's like, wow, that's the power of digital, you know, all the Spotifys and things like that. I don't know how these people heard my songs, you know. That's how they heard it, and they know them.
Right.
So it's pretty amazing, yeah.
Can we hear a little bit?
Sure. "Did that California sun not warm your skin the way you thought it would?
Heard you left with no goodbyes again. Put a hurt on Hollywood. Gypsy woman, don't you think it's time you come around? Gypsy woman, when you gonna lay your leaving down?
You do a cool thing in Nashville called the Honky Tonk Experience.
Yeah.
How'd you come up with this idea? This is where you basically, you kind of recreate a little bit of the past, right? And you bring some people that are well known to come in and really create that live small venue experience in a club that's called the Exit Inn, right?
Yeah, the Exit Inn. It's a cool old rock joint, really. And got a big stage and very few seats, mainly, you know, standing in front of the stage, mainly. We just was wanting to draw some awareness, you know, to me as a recording artist rather than a songwriter. And my buddy Gaddis, him and his wife, was talking. She's in the music business as well. And he was like, man, we used to do a thing in L.A., me and Waylon Payne, and it was called Eastbound and Down. He said, and, you know, we just started inviting friends, and we'd all get up and jam. And he said, and then one night Dwight Yoakam showed up, and that's how I got, you know, he was Dwight Yoakam's band leader after that, played guitar with him. And he was like, you need to start something like that. We need to do something here. So we came up with Honky Tonk Experience. And actually, Harlan Howard's son, Perry,
oh, really?
Was the one who said, hey, man, a buddy of mine books the Exit Inn. You ought to do it over there. So we went over there, and, you know, we just throwing stuff in the wind, you know, to see what would happen. We didn't know anybody would show up. And, man, the first show, our guest was Alison Krauss showed up, and Jamie Johnson and Randy Houser, and we was off to the races after that. And now you got people, you know, that want to come play it. They call and want to play on it now.
Oh, you need
We've had everybody from some of the Foo Fighters,
yeah,
Black Crowes to, you know, Brothers Osborne. There's just, they've been to several of them. And matter of fact, John Osborne played guitar one night all night long with us. He's just like, I want to come play. I was like, we'll have your rig set up, man.
That sounds like an album. You should have an album of that, the Honky Tonk Experience, Volume 1, 2, 3.
That could happen. That could happen.
let's bring us down for that. We'll do it. We'll do a fun
Absolutely.
Little podcast.
Absolutely,
that'd
be fun. Yeah.
You know, a lot of this does pass down to generations. Your kids have now, you know, God bless your wife for letting you move to Nashville when you had like a 7 and 8 year old, okay? Because she's in here laughing at us. But, you know, I know you guys must be tight because this thing stuck together.
Through some lean years, and and it's been relatively easy pretty well.
But your kids don't perform, but they're in the music business.
They are. My daughter works in marketing and PR, and my son works at a company called BMI. That collects royalties for songwriters.
Nice.
Yeah, he works in the licensing department.
So what do you think is next for you? You know, I mean, I think this could be a real moment. You know, we had Waylon Payne on, too.
Oh, I love Waylon.
God,
man.
He's
We've
good.
Written some great songs.
He's
I love that guy.
He's a great singer.
Oh, he's one of the best.
I mean, you know, and you're wondering, like, listening to him, because I've listened to him up close like this, and you're like, why are you not famous?
Right.
But he's a great guy.
Oh, and he's I bet he's a great interview, too.
He's fun.
He's such a character, man.
He is. He's great. But, I mean, you know, this is a real moment for you, and it seems like things are changing for real singers. And
I hope you're right. I mean, it seems like it is. We've got a good little team assembled, you know, from our PR team to our management and stuff, and they're making some – they're shaking some bushes, you know, making some stuff go on and getting me on cool things like this, you know, and getting my name out there. And, I think 2018 could be interesting. You know, we're working on some tour stuff. Hopefully, you know, first of the year we'll find out if we can get on a couple of these tours, you know. That I got my wish list is, of course, you know, wish lists, but nothing written in stone yet. But it's coming together.
Well, I tell you, the title track for this album, "Low Down and Lonesome," is a real powerhouse song as well. I'm sure it's a crowd pleaser.
It's
definitely something to start the party with.
Yeah.
Can we hear a little bit of that as we go out?
Well, I ain't ever been been to Folsom, but I've damn sure done my time trying to please a woman, trying to walk the line. When she washed her hands with all love, I went right straight down the drain, straight down the tubes with the booze and blues where the fools and losers hang. Now I'm low down and lonesome, but I feel right at home, 'cause I've done grown accustomed to sinking like a stone. Since I hit rock bottom, I've been high as I can be. Ever since that woman put that look down and lonesome on me.
Yes, Kendall Marvel, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me, Brad. Appreciate it.
Before we let you go, we want to welcome you to the B-side, Stories from the Road. Here's a chance for us to have a little fun and tell one last story. As Kendall was packing up, we asked him what was the wildest thing that ever happened to him on the road. Here's a crazy exchange that he witnessed backstage at a Kenny Chesney concert. Apparently, roadies have groupies too. Well, this is what happens when these relationships go the wrong way.
Tell me a fun story.
Well, it's not fun. It was actually crazy. We was backstage at a Kenny Chesney concert in Atlanta, me and my publisher and my buddy Casey. And Casey's written a lot of Chesney stuff. And
Casey Beathard.
Yeah. And we had a thing called the Vibe Room. And we'd been drinking, you know, pretty heavy. And we was walking out of the Vibe Room. It's kind of like after party that Kenny has, all the opening acts and stuff. And we walk out, and this girl hits this guy with a high heel shoe, and it sticks in his head. And, you know, just like, and it was like a Quentin Tarantino movie. This poor guy was bleeding everywhere. And Casey was down there, you know, trying to help him. And Kenny walks out and thought Casey had hit him.
Oh,
and he was like, "Casey, he works for me. What'd you do?" And he's like, "No, no, no. She hit him with a shoe." And he was like, "What? She hit him with a shoe?" You know, so that's kind of crazy.
Yeah, the life of a rock star, right?
Yeah.
And one more quick one. The songwriter Harlan Howard has been mentioned on this podcast so much, I think we're afraid we're going to get a call from his estate someday. But here's a priceless little gem about Harlan and his son Perry that Kendall told me as he was packing up his guitar on the way out of the studio.
I meant to tell you a while ago, and I wish I should have got on this story, but Perry Howard told me, was talking about Harlan, you know, with
his
dad. And Harlan drank a lot.
Yeah.
And he said Perry used to drive him around. He always drank White Russians. That was his drink.
Oh,
and he had this 60-something, you know, Buick or something, one of them big long cars.
Yeah, yeah.
And he'd always ride in the back seat, and Perry would drive him around. And Perry pulled out in front of somebody one day, and they about got hit. And said, Harley said, "God damn it, son, I can see the headlines tomorrow. Famous songwriter and unknown driver killed in wreck."
Next week, John Michael Montgomery stops by with his son, Walker. It's a fun look back at what it was like growing up with a country crooner who had a bit of a rock and roll attitude himself. Don't miss Father and Son sing John Michael's big hit, Life's a Dance, next week only on Children of Song, the podcast that combines live music with great storytelling. Till next time, I'm Brad Newman. Thanks for listening.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.
Listen to Fox News podcast shows ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or follow wherever you get your podcasts.